Welcome back, everybody, to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, and this week we have a special guest with us, Brian Pazos, a hitting trainer at 108 Performance. I first met Brian Pazos when I was coaching out at 108 Performance as a strength coach there, and since leaving there, Brian's become one of their hitting trainers, and we've had some great discussions about movement and motor learning, and I'm really excited to have him on today. Brian, do you want to give us an introduction to yourself?
Yeah, sure. First, thanks for having me on. Appreciate that. But yeah, I guess I'll just jump right into it. I was a hitter who was kind of obsessed at an early age with finding out, you know, why certain things worked and why certain things didn't. By the time I had gotten to 108, I had, you know, like, you know, two or three notebooks filled up with
things I'd taken from
different guys. And in college, I realized I was more of a cage rat and a gym rat than I had initially thought I was. So that kind of led me into, you know, wanting to dive deeper into like the coaching side. Okay, well, how do both, you know, the cage setting and the gym setting help facilitate, you know, an athlete's success overall. So by the time I made the transition to the coaching side, I started to realize, okay, well, this is a lot more affecting this environment than I initially thought, you know, because as an athlete, you're only really thinking about things from your perspective and what you need to do, but that's already complex enough when you start applying it to, okay, now how do I apply that to four different hitters or 10 different hitters, or, you know, and it gets bigger and bigger from there.
Dude, you brought up so many good points in that. I like, just going back to what you said about having notebooks, you want to tell me a little bit more about that? I mean, I wasn't a guy that did notebooks, but I see the value in that. Do you kind of want to explain more of some of the benefits that you've found or what helped you gravitate towards keeping a journal or a notebook?
Yeah, sure. I think for me, it was kind of one of those things that I saw big leaguers doing it, so I assumed it was something that I also needed to do. So surely something I adopted to like think, okay, well, if I did this, it would lead to that. And, you know, I heard later on or found out from a few psychologists talking about, okay, when you write, talk, or read, you're able to kind of express certain ideas you haven't explored. So for me, being able to write things down, I knew that was the way. Yeah, that was the way I could, you know, process information and know that, you know, I had given my brain enough time to slow down and actually, you know, think about what was going on or why. Mm-hmm. And I would say, kind of started the most when I realized in school, you know, that I wasn't always paying attention, but if I could just read the book and take good notes, I would do just fine on the test. And so, you know, in high school and college, I kind of got away with, you know, minimal effort, maximal results in school. And then I started to kind of apply the writing aspect a little more to hitting because it was the only thing I, you know, took very, very seriously. So being able to write down ideas and track my thoughts in terms of like, okay, what was working and what wasn't working. I actually ran into in summer ball this guy who really kind of solidified that practice for me, Tim Wheeler. I believe he's the coach at Sac State right now, hitting coach, but he was a year out of the minors with the Rockies. He played a few years there, and he basically told me and noticed that like I'd taken a ton of notes during summer ball, and I was kind of struggling at the time, and he said, hey, like, don't ever let anyone like stop you from thinking, because that's who you are. You just have to learn how to think. So in terms of simplifying, he's like, just focus on two things. Try to write down like whatever you believe is your hitting absolute and like things that must happen and things that must not happen during the swing. And you know, it'll change as you adapt and as you get new experiences and see what works and what doesn't work. But that's kind of where it solidified it for me. So instead of a million thoughts going a million different directions, it was easy to simplify. Okay, this works, this doesn't work. So yeah, tying it back now, it's kind of how I've been able to become interested in a lot of the other aspects that affect a hitter or a performer in any environment.
So what were some of the benefits that you derived from it? Like, what things did you find? Because, like, for myself, I'm a big thinker, and I was way too much in my head. And I really liked how you said that the one coach was telling you, you need to figure out how to think. So how did the journal help you figure out how to think?
Oh, sure. To oversimplify and to overcomplicate, we're often, you know, I think those are my things. I think that's the same with any overthinker. So, mm-hmm. you know, finding a balance between those two and kind of like letting those two voices negotiate themselves out on paper. Mm-hmm. But the way I saw direct benefit was over a few weeks, or if I hadn't looked at, you know, what I'd written for a month or so, I could look mm-hmm. back and the days that I had written the least on my paper, like for my hitting journal, mm-hmm. and the days I had written the most were completely different performance days. Like when I wrote the least okay. amount, I was probably feeling really good and I was only focusing on one or two things. Uh-huh. The days where I had written out like an entire plan for the next day, I was like, okay, I was probably not hitting very good that week. Like, uh-huh. And so it started to help me realize it's like, okay, less is better, and kind of helped me come to the idea that, okay, I can either worry about 10 things that could go wrong, or I could just focus on the two things I knew were going to help me like feel right. Mm-hmm. So simplifying my thoughts in that way and then seeing what it looked like on paper, it's like, oh, okay, that's how you think and that's how you need to think to be successful.
So what were those like few things that you that really helped you be successful at the plate? What were those few things that you were thinking and or focusing on?
Okay, I think most of my life I'd focused on the mechanical aspects of everything in my body that needed to go right. Mm-hmm. And towards the end, I started to realize it was a lot more simple. It kind of sounded like those interviews that big leaguers have when they hit a clutch home run or, mm-hmm. you know, a clutch extra base hit, you know, oh, I was just trying to get a good pitch to hit. Mm-hmm. And for me, that kind of says it all. That was kind of what clicked for me, that the visual component of hitting was so big for me that I was like, oh, I was always a kid that could just swing at any pitch in the zone and I would put it in play somehow and have to run it out, you know, hard to first base. And then when it started to click, it was like, hey, if you just wait for your pitch, like, well, then you could do damage with it.
Yeah.
And the more and more you start listening to these, you know, big leaguers talk about, I heard David Ortiz on MLB Network one time. He was like, it's undervalued, you know, that aside from the mechanics, if you just go in there and practice your zone, you practice your zone every single day. That's how you become a good hitter. Mm-hmm. I was just, you know, scratching back through Ted Williams stuff, and he was just talking about the number one thing is like get a good pitch to hit.
Yeah,
it's like it felt as simple as that, you know.
Yeah,
you know, towards the end there, so finding ways to incorporate a visual component into hitting, it's like, well, that's, you know, 90% of it,
and oh,
I think
absolutely.
It kind of connected. It kind of connected the type of thinking, like that instinctual thinking, that reactionary thinking we wanted to access rather than like the slow and methodical thinking. Like mm-hmm. that's what it felt like to think the right way in a game. It was just seeing, knowing what to look for, knowing what to expect visually. And it's like, oh, that pitch is coming. Okay, now I'm prepared for it timing wise, mm-hmm. rather than me trying to guess how I needed to change my body mid game in order to be more on time. It's like,
yeah.
It became more and more visual, I guess.
Dude, that's so good, especially from when we start diving more into like the motor learning stuff, the ecological dynamics, like all of that, you know, when you talk about being in the zone, like I can think of all the different ways that that like fits within an ecological framework and, mm-hmm. and all that sort of stuff. So kind of what have you been diving into on that front and learning? What's been kind of catching your eye and kind of getting the wheels turning for you?
Oh, sure. So after our last conversation, I remembered the name David's. I remember you throwing mm-hmm. it out. And so I looked it up on YouTube. I was like, okay, well, I got a few hours here. And it was a speech or a lecture at a skills conference, I believe. And he was basically identifying, okay, what is actually being acquired in the process of skill acquisition.
Yeah.
And then kind of defined it as like, okay, well, like, it's not necessarily that it's so simple that, oh, once we have that skill ingrained in our mind, we can just repeat it automatically. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, it's not always that simple. It's more like you're acquiring this understanding of like certain relationships. And he described it as like, oh, you're acquiring a process of coordination. It's like, okay, well, that makes sense because it speaks to the mechanics. It speaks to mechanics aligning with approach. It speaks to, you know, the body and the mind aligning with, you know, the eyes, like we were just kind of talking about. Mm-hmm, so basically coordinating everything made more sense of that term emergence that's thrown around. It's like, yeah. Oh, okay. When everything kind of connects and builds up to kind of break through where it's like, you didn't have to force the information upon the performer. They were almost like slapped on all sides of the forehead with it. And
yeah,
it just kind of happens.
There's
so it definitely made me kind of look at, you know, the idea of self-organization in a new light. It's like, yeah. Oh, it's not so simple as I thought it was.
Oh, for sure.
That's the main thing.
And that's the beauty of it. It's like the concepts are so simple, but when you dig under the surface, like they are very deep and they have deep roots that give these concepts a lot of strength. But one of the things that you kind of hit on in terms of like things just kind of emerging, like one of the other concepts that I think you kind of touched on was like this concept of resonance, which essentially means like your system becomes, it begins to resonate at a certain frequency. Like the example that I think they use is like a radio. And when you get dialed in to the correct frequency, it just like you're just in sync essentially, and you're able to kind of resonate at that, and like the skill or the coordination pattern just comes out, and it's not something that you are like, you know, trying to force essentially.
Yeah.
And I think that's go ahead.
No, I was just say that feeling you're describing, those are like the days where whatever you throw at a hitter, they're like, yeah, I like that. That's exactly what I'm feeling. And when that keeps happening and they keep hitting, it's like, oh, okay, that's what it feels like. But trying to get there is hard. But when it does happen, that's kind of the addicting part of being a part of that process.
I mean, because, again, this comes back to, like, attunement. I feel like it's always fun to talk about it because just trying to figure out better ways of describing what that term means. I was talking to a hitting coach recently and they're like, what does that term mean exactly? And it just like, to me, like when we're talking about this, becoming attuned to the information, meaning being able to pick up on it and utilize it, isn't one of those processes where, well, at least through the search process, there's effort and there's frustration and there's failure, but that search process is where you become, you begin to start picking up that information and then being able to lock on to that and to be able to pick it up, I guess, in a way without a ton of effort. So, you know, I think that's where, with what we're talking about, at least for me, that's my goal as a coach, is trying to figure out how can I get the information sources within the training environment so that the hitter can work through trying to pick up that information and begin to interact with it. And then as a coach, I will introduce different constraints to try to help them with that search process.
No, definitely. That makes a ton of sense. It's like, if I understand what you're saying correctly, it's like that environment should allow them to almost like map their own progress. They're almost well aware of if they got it or not, rather than like being told what to have or what to feel. And then, did you get it or not? Right.
Yeah.
And like kind of what I get from the whole, you know, ecological dynamics perspective is like the ability to create nonlinear connections. Like how many nonlinear connections can you make with information? And so, you know, I was, you know, talking to somebody about this the other day, and I was like, when you think about how students, like in a classroom setting, will interact with information, like you give them all the answers, or if you make the answers almost so easy to come across, like which of those two environments are the students actually going to take the most from? It's like, well, every time I got the answers given to me, I don't remember a single thing on that test.
But oh, for sure.
When, you know, when a professor was, you know, captivating and it's hard not to learn something in that class, it was like, well, I barely had to read the book to go, you know, re-digest the information. I had already made the connections, or the connections were graspable on their own. You know, you didn't, the professor didn't have to try to hammer it into my head. It was like, you know, picked up on, just like you said. So what it kind of took me these last few weeks is like, you know, understanding I kind of can't get paralyzed between like, okay, well, there's so many factors. I can either, you know, make, you know, really good changes or really bad changes depending on all these things. But I think understanding a balance of, you know, a bunch of different factors, and that's kind of given me a lot better perspective on how at least I want to, you know, create a training environment for hitters is, okay, give it some direction, give it some freedom, give it some, you know, structure, give it some fluidity, like just a balance of both ends where, you know, we can kind of get the point across and they can pick up the rest of the slack on the other end.
I mean, too, like when it comes to this, they also need to be able to explore, and sometimes they're going to get it wrong. And that process of getting it wrong helps them figure out where the edges are. Like,
yeah, for
I think that's where, too, it's also making it giving them freedom to misinterpret it, the information. And then you're there to also help them, help guide them back towards the correct interpretation, meaning like, nah, it's not quite like that. Like that's where, you know, having these types of conversations and, you know, with people like yourself and other coaches who, you know these concepts really well. I've done that with my mentor and one of my other colleagues. You know, I'll continually message them, you know, my understanding of these ideas, mostly to check my understanding, but I will push the envelope in terms of like, you know, their understanding of it. And then I'll take it, you know, like to the next logical step or what I think may be a logical step, or I'll combine it with a different idea. And these are the types of things that we need our hitters to do with like the different sorts of concepts, you know, whether we're talking about like a kickback, whether we're talking hold the ground, whether we're talking any number of things. Like we need to let our hitters, you know, explore and run with those ideas. And sometimes it may look different than what we thought, and it may be wrong, but I think we have to let them explore and create an environment where they can explore with those things and, you know, make some mistakes. And then we're there to help them figure out what is their most optimal self-organization, you know, process, essentially.
Yeah. No, definitely. I think that concept of exploration, I mean, I'd obsess and talk about it at length, but I replace that word with play, like this aspect of play, that there is no, you know, there is no true care in the success or failure of it. It's, you know, purely exploration. It's purely like, okay, how many ways can I mess with this to make this work?
Yeah.
And then in that sense, you get a way deeper understanding of, you know,
I want to interject real quick that idea of like, how many different ways can I do this? Like that's the concept and idea of dexterity. And I believe too, degeneracy. And degeneracy is just like, how many different ways can you accomplish the same task? Or like with like maybe some changing, I have to look up the definition, but anyways, those two ideas like are very much related to what you're talking about. Dexterity for sure. So carry on, dude, you're on a great, great little rant.
Yeah, no, but it's that right there that like you're saying, it's like, how many ways can you accomplish the same task? Like I was thinking about, okay, well, you give a kid one move to play with, a movement to play with, and you allow them to really perfect this movement over and over again, and you give it different tasks. So you, rather than giving them multiple movements, you know, in a certain swing session, you let them almost get a chance to explore the ins and outs of one move, you know, because that ability to understand the relationship between success and failure is more important than one of those on their own. Like when they understand the relationship between why they've succeeded and why they've failed, it only brings them closer to the answer or the movement solution, if we want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. So when they get a chance to explore, obviously with guidance, like you explained, like when you give them the proper means to explore and the proper information that can converge on their brains to be able to make something click, like a lot of light bulb moments happen when you play with something, not when you're necessarily told. And we talked about this last time, but you know, my dad would explain over and over again how to ride a bike. And I was just like, how is that going to work? How is that going to work? You think there's only two wheels. And then it's not until you're riding it that it goes, oh, that's what my dad was saying. That's what my buddy was telling me about what he, like, then it all kind of like comes together in your brain. But until you're actually on the bike playing with the object or playing with the idea of what somebody explained to you, you don't really know what they mean. You don't really know what is meant. And you don't really get a feel for it. And so that exploration, you know, kind of to dive into another topic I've kind of been thinking about a lot lately is the difference between thinking and feeling. Like it's almost like your brain's split in half, and like there are times for processing a lot of information and, you know, okay, why did this happen? You know, what can I do differently? And that's kind of slow and methodical, but that feeling aspect is it's quick, it's instinctual, it's the type of reactionary behavior that you're looking to find. And when you dive into the ins and outs of like how to play and how to play deliberately, well, that's a whole new level of practice. That's something that's more important than giving a kid the answer. It's like when this kid knows how to play with something, and you like, I love watching the kids that I'll step out. And it's like nothing changed. I'll like step out to go to the bathroom. I'll be like peeking from the corner and they're just like sitting there hammering in that move. And it's like, okay, yeah, they're really engaged with it now versus, you know, there's other kids who will wait for you and be told like, wait to be told what to do next versus the kid who's just running with it. And if you can provide an environment where the kid can just run with something, like that's way more engaging than, you know, all the mechanics that we think they might need at a certain age, right? Because it's more complex than just one thing.
Oh, for sure.
But,
and that's the other thing too, is like, how can we also, more than just like trying to hammer one thing in, how can we also get them to better understand that one thing in relationship to other things? Like, kind of like going back to the bike analogy, sometimes you got to fall to either side, you know, and try different things. And that by doing different things, maybe you actually perceive it better. Like one of the things that I took away from Franz Bosch's first book was if like you get the same stimulus over and over again, your body perceives it as monotonous and then it begins to tune it out, or it begins to downregulate the signal, just in the same way that like, generally, most people don't feel their clothes on their body, you know, like without like, you know, like you just kind of focus and you're like, oh, there they are. But for the most part, like you don't really notice them because your body perceives it as monotonous. And so one of the things I think too often happens is we do the same thing over and over again. And what ultimately ends up happening when we're trying to like do one drill over and over again, you actually lose feel. Like you lose feel for what you're doing. And it's like, well, maybe that's why your reps at the beginning of your round were better. And, you know, like this whole idea that we need to have a perfect round, you have like one mistake and you're like, oh, I got to keep going till I actually get it perfect again. It's like, well, one, when does that ever exist in a game where you get to like, oh, hold on, you know, hey, ump, you know, hold on, one more at bat. And it's like, no, you go sit down.
And you don't get to do that.
And this goes back to what you were talking about before of like, you know, like being more instinctual versus spending a lot of time processing. The beautiful thing about baseball is like you're allowed to do both to a certain extent. I mean,
exactly.
And you get a definitive amount of time and it varies, you know, like when you go back to the bench and you sit down, you get to process that. But once you get out on the field and you
Have
know,
be,
it's,
yeah.
it's go time. You got to flush it so that you're present in the moment, whether you're on offense or on defense. So, I mean, I think all these things are good. And that's what, one of the things that I really, think is so beautiful about baseball is like you can have all these elements present and there's a space for all of them.
Yeah. And I think that balance of knowing when, like you explained, it's like baseball has all these things, but the constraint of having all these things is you got to know the time and place mm-hmm. for each mm-hmm. of those things. Right. And taking that bike analogy further, like exactly what you said, when it gets monotonous, it's like learning how to ride a bike. Like how many more times do you need to ride it to know what you felt that one time, you know? And, sure. and I don't think kids don't trust that enough in their rounds. It's like, you just did that three times in a row. Like you did it with three individual pitches, three times in a row. That's like getting three hits in three different at bats. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Three pitches. But you know, at that point I don't know who said it, but it was during that skills conference thing that Keith Davis was talking about. It's like, once you felt it, it's not really about the physical repetition mm-hmm. so much as it is, you know, the connection of what you felt, what you were thinking, where the pitch was, you know, how you were trying to repeat it again is more important than the actual repetition itself.
Well, and that's
so,
well, that with that, it's to me, it's more about like the process, because remember, mm-hmm. like the whole idea of rep without rep, you, because everything changes from moment to moment, it's more about that process and that process of how you connect with that information. And not only that, mm-hmm. like this is where, to me, I think it's also being in the right mental state. And how much does like breathing and your mental process of getting your mm-hmm. body in the right arousal, like all the intrinsic dynamics, meaning like things that are going on internally, getting those things right and in tune with the environment and with the information out there is like huge to be able to repeat stuff because mm-hmm. things are changing and things are dynamic. I think we actually need to, as coaches, spend more time on that process versus just doing the reps, because I think that's going to overcome a lot of things like fatigue that is going to happen to players throughout a season, and any number of like things like pressure, any number of other things. I think that's going to really help out players be successful when it comes to game time.
Yeah. And you know, it reminds me of something you were just talking about. I heard this quote from Everything is Fucked, that book. I've been listening to an audiobook, and he's Everything is Fucked. It's a book about
okay.
I believe it's Mark Manson, but it's a book that he talks about, you know, one of the things that he talks about is, you know, your identity stays your identity until it interacts with a new experience.
Oh, sure.
So I think that's kind of what you're saying. It's like, if you apply that to, you know, performance and hitting, it's like once you've repeated that one time, like baseball kind of demands that, okay, if you do that in a game, you hit one fastball, you're not getting that again. It's going to be a new experience now that you're going to be challenged with, because you've already progressed. Mm-hmm. If you've progressed, like, that's kind of the point, right? You're continuing to progress. So if I think what I'm hearing you say, if I'm hearing it right, it's basically talking about preparing these kids for that adaptive behavior rather than focusing on just the adaptation. It's like, we can't repeat the adaptation. We have to try and build a behavior that is adaptive and reactive.
Well, it's more the fact of like, you can't hold on to things. Like, that moment is past, it's gone. Like, so it's very interesting. Like, the difference between, I heard an apologist kind of talk about like how when you get your degree, you know, like, does anything you do change it? You know, like once you have your degree, you always have your degree. And I think that's kind of how we oftentimes think about like acquiring a skill. Versus like you acquire a physique. So once you acquire a physique, you got like your six pack abs, you know, you're just built. You can't just then go kick back on the couch and then start pounding beers and pizzas, you know, for the next 6 months and still have, you know, that chiseled six pack and that bod. Like, that's more of like how like hitting and skills oftentimes are, they're not like you have it and you always have it. I mean, sometimes I do think to a certain extent, it's kind of weird that like we talk about it, talk about things like riding a bike. Riding a bike is a very interesting example. And I think it's a good counterpoint, I believe, to a certain extent, to some of the ecological dynamic stuff. It's like, that seems to be something that like, once you got it, you got it. You know, I wonder what other skills like, but I also wonder
but
if
I
like,
think you could take it further. I think you could take it further with the riding the bike thing. Cause I think that's the tangent I never finished, but you don't just, once you learn to ride and you become, you know, dive deeper into the practice or art of riding a bike, it's like, okay, well, there's going off of curbs. And then once you've mastered going off of curbs, it's like short ramps, then it's a half pipe, then it's tricks, then it's flips. Like, then there's, you know, there's a million things you could do way deeper. So I think that complexity kind of, almost infinite. Like it could go its own way.
But I almost wonder though, if we're talking from like an ecological dynamics perspective, like your ability to interact with that information once you've found it, and what that specifying information is, maybe when it comes to the bike and like, you know, your inner ear or whatever, like it now understands what information to be sensitive to keep you upright when it comes to the bike. Whereas other information and the ability to pick it up may be more difficult for the human movement system. Like the speed at which like you need to pick up information for, you know, a 90 mile an hour fastball, that may decay, you know, a lot faster than your inner ear's ability to maintain balance when you get on a bike. So, I mean, maybe that would be why, like, you know, you're able to, you know, once you learn how to ride a bike, you're, you know, pretty much always able to ride a bike. But I mean, I think though, like that's kind of the point that I was trying to make though, about like once you like hit like a fastball, let's say it's the same pitch, same location, same speed off the same pitcher. Even if you've done it once, things internally may change, or things may change in the environment. And so you have to be able to repeat that process and have that ability to solve problems, to have your system be dynamic enough to be able to change. Let's say the only factor that's different is now, instead of it being like 75 and sunny, it's, 45, super windy and cloudy, and you're cold, you know, like
that makes all the difference.
And so, you know, or something's different with the, you know, the opposing bench is more now, getting on you, or, you know, you did something embarrassing, you tripped out of the box, or you tripped, those different things will change that from moment to moment and make each, at bat unique. And so I think it's really about trying to get guys to be good problem solvers and being able to solve any problem that may show up in the course of a game.
I was looking back at something I wrote that you're talking about, that how many ways can you accomplish the same task?
It's like,
okay, the task is always hit the ball, but the amount of pitch combinations, tunnels, and speeds that you can mess with, like that's a million different factors. Like I sat down one day this week and I was like, okay, what are all of the factors that not only affect, you know, the physical environment, but like that individual hitter's like psychological state, like, you know, what's he feeling? What's he thinking? Like, or, you know, how is that person getting pitched? You know, how much are they paying attention to warm-up pitches? Like how much, you know, the umpire is affecting your game. Like there are so many things. So, you know, one of the things we can look at with, you know, more of the elite athletes, everybody talks about their ability to almost be unfazed by all of these distractions, if you want to call them distractions, you know, factors. Like they have an ability to lock in a different way. And so how we separate, you know, the things that develop that unique aspect in an athlete, Like, I think that's kind of entirely separate from the mechanics portion that everyone, you know, wants to talk about. Everyone to make, you know, Miguel Cabrera's and Mike Trout's in physical makeup, but completely disregard the psychological makeup that comes with that, right? Like, these are
for sure
professional athletes who have conditioned their minds to expect to be up way earlier than everybody else, that expect a certain level of success. Like when I'm feeding to, you know, elite high school kids and, you know, they mess up, it's way different when you feed to a professional player and they mess up and it's you know, it's a completely different reaction. You watch, you know, big league all-stars when they take BP. Like, I was watching Christian Yelich take BP. He hooks about 7 balls to the second baseman, just, you know, top spun, you know, way out in front. But his demeanor is like he just hit all those balls, you know, over the fence. You know, Lindor, you know, he's peppering the other side of, like, the bubble, just late on everything. But he's probably feeling something in their demeanor of, like, not getting pulled out by that. That makeup has, in my opinion, such a bigger impact on confidence than the mechanics do, because confidence is not physical. It's as much as it is emotional, right? Like, you feel confident. Someone can tell you as much preparation as you've had, but you don't feel confident unless you feel that your preparation was enough.
Yeah.
So I think, like, how do I train kids to be quote unquote, like, mentally, you know, focused? How do I teach a kid to concentrate on what he's feeling? Like, that's, I guess, what my interest has been shifted from, you know, since we talked last. It's like, okay, well, there's, you know, there's a lot of factors that will affect a kid. For example, the other night there was a new kid coming in, and his older brother, he's kind of tough on him, you know, older brother, he's sitting in the cage behind him, and you can just see this kid in the box, like, kind of tensing up. So we're me and the other trainer, John Pacheco was noticing this too, that the kid would set up in the box with his hands on his shoulders, and it's almost like a voice popped into his head. The kid would, like, put his hand to a specific spot and kind of jump there, almost like he forgot. And so, you know, he was kind of tense. The swings were kind of here and there. And then as soon as I started engaging the older brother in conversation, while they were hitting in the cage, you know, the more and more the brother stopped paying attention to what was happening. And this kid, you know, it was like seeing a different hitter.
Yeah.
So that's like every kid performing in front of their parents. Like,
yeah,
you know, those psychological barriers to
environmental constraints.
Yeah.
And you can manipulate,
like,
those.
That matters. For sure. Like that. Like, and that's what I told, because I was introducing a lot of stuff to Pacheco, and I was like, stuff that I'd found. And I was like, did you notice how as soon as his brother was distracted, it was a completely different hitter? It's like, sometimes, like, there weren't any mechanical cues that were going to change that. It was him knowing that he could fail a little bit.
Right.
And it's like, you know, you ask a hitter a question and their dad answers for them. It's like, well, now I know what your dad wants you to work on, but, you know, what if the kid had something different in mind that he was feeling? Now the kid's confused on what he wants to work on because, you know, the dad might be saying something different, or, you know, the mom, you know, whoever it is in that kid's life. Like, there are millions of psychological barriers with self-esteem, with confidence, with focus, with, you know, level of care, level of investment that are going to be more important than, all right, did I give him the right mechanical cue? Because it's like, well, it could be 4 different mechanical cues that could help. But it's probably 1 or 2 things that are, like, making or breaking this kid's day. And I have to be aware of that.
We might have touched on this on the last podcast that we recorded, was KPIs, key performance inhibitors. And so, like, what you're describing about, like, the sociocultural, like, environmental constraint here, like, that becomes a key performance inhibitor that, like, all athletes, like, deal with that pressure, but they don't all respond the same way. And it affects their ability to coordinate, right? So, like, what you can utilize, what you were talking about with, like, the brother, because you know that affects his movement patterns. And so, like, as you work with him, you can try to introduce that back in to see how well he's able to problem solve and coordinate. Mm-hmm. So you can use that as a constraint to even test whether or not the stuff that you've been doing with him is holding, because just think of like what happens if his brother shows up at a game and it happens to be a big game, you know, or yeah, like there are other people that like have a similar will divide or shift his focus of attention when he's playing the game. So, I mean, and one of the other things that like came to mind when you were talking about like how much the mental state plays in, it reminded me of, I believe it's Coastal Carolina when they won the College mm-hmm. World Series, and they had like a sheet of paper taped to their water jug that said, will over skill. Like, and how much mm-hmm. like your intention, this goes back to perception and action, and intention is part of that perception action kind of coupling. And how much your intention mm-hmm. affects your ability to coordinate / self-organize effectively. And these yeah. are things that, like, when you go back to what you were talking about in your journal and how you only had one or two things that you were really focused on, like, that becomes your intention. Your intention to just look for a good pitch in the zone to hit, you mm-hmm. know, or just, like, trying to command the zone, and like, that's where to me, like ecological dynamics is just so powerful in its ability to, in its explanatory power, to be able yeah, to just help sure. better frame like, oh, this is how all this fits together. And how intention actually, creates and generates your mechanics. So instead of giving you a mechanical cue, if I just change your intention, that may fix your mechanical issue. So that's where I think we need to appreciate this other side of the coin when it comes to mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And when you talk about intention, I think that's something that like a lot of coaches talk about, but they don't realize they're addressing that factor. Like every time a coach right. says, hey, like just hit a ground ball or just be easy, like mm-hmm. just, you know, they're trying to shift the attention, but that works with some kids and that doesn't work with some kids, because it depends on how that kid perceives the language.
Oh, right? For
and
sure.
I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know what you think about this, but I think mechanics is more a function of language mm-hmm. and personal feel than it is about, you know, what needs to happen, right? Like it's less scientific, I think, than people make it, you know, like when you're talking sure. about mechanics of an individual's swing or mechanics of an individual's shot or throw, like, you know, whatever it is, I think we don't always pay attention to the fact, like, okay, how is this kid even perceive, you know, the words that I'm using?
Because that's, well, it's important. Not even that. It's the actions everything. That you are using while you're describing it too. Because oftentimes when we're yeah, yeah. describing yeah. words to people, like we're using hand gestures, we're using different body movements. Like even now as I'm talking about mm-hmm. this, like I'm like moving my hips and I'm like trying to slap my arms.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah, definitely.
So like we talk with our bodies as well. And it's also like, yeah, how does the person perceive that? And everybody is going to perceive it differently. And then also the question is how does their body perceive it when they go to move? Which may be mm-hmm. different than how they intellectually perceive it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it was one of the things that jumped to mind when we were talking about how different, you know, factors can inhibit performance, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it may be. And so there was this linkage I saw. Well, first off, I'll say I know absolutely nothing about quantum mechanics, but I was curious.
I don't
know. I watched a video on this stuff called interference patterns with
okay.
basically tracking how electrons move when we measure them versus when we don't measure them. So when we measure them, they only act as particles, if I understand it correctly. But when we're not measuring them, they act in waves. So it's kind of unexplainable. And a lot of the reason why quantum mechanics theory is, you know, it posed more questions than answers, but it's still interesting because I think of the same application, you know. Let me apply it to a hitting setting. Well, like this happens every day where, you know, a kid finds it, you know, he's just trying to like continue to feel it, and he's good for a round. And we're like, okay, now that we know that it's good, let's get video now. And as soon as you pull out the video, it's like, okay, where was the hitter? Where was the hitter that was just here 5 minutes ago?
Because, right.
You know, them trying to perform to record it. That's something that we gotta understand. That's
another environmental constraint.
The rap solo, all the old school guys see this happening every day. They're like, okay, the old school guys can't get on board with hit tracks and rap solo because it's like, okay, this is affecting their ability to concentrate on what they need to do to hit in a game rather than what they need to do to beat their contemporaries' exit velocity.
Right.
So, I mean, what kids have inside the environment get affected? Like, who is ready, you know, to have that much feedback in their hitting, training performance or their training environment?
Yeah.
You know, who's ready to have that much information or not? And it's crazy because that kind of leads me into something I listened to from Rob Gray's podcast about practicing being, you know, a social learning experience. So when there's another kid who's training, you know, how does that affect the environment? You know, how does group learning tie into it? And, you know, I kind of combine these two things, that idea with the CEO of Zappos. He has this thing about wanting to create as many collisions as possible. And he defines collisions as serendipitous personal encounters. So, you know, it's less about the company, but how many collisions, how many personal encounters can we create? And my favorite thing is like when one of the kids cuts me off and he's like, can I give him a cue? I'm like, dude, go for it. Yes. Cause you're seeing something else. And when I was a kid, well, like I have to think as a coach, I'm the parent in the situation. And when my parents would tell me things, I'm like, maybe I'll go check it out. But then my friend's older brother says it, and I'm like, hey mom, like, you know, you were right. And it's like, well, sometimes that's what the kid needs. And do I want credit or do I want the kid to find it? Cause I'd rather have the kid find it. And, cause they'll put it into 9-year-old language. You know, I only know I can try my best to dumb it down, but a 13-year-old connects with another 13-year-old way better than I can. So I think that's another undervalued, you know, part of it. And I think why I've enjoyed working with larger groups rather than one-on-one sessions, because it's like, well, sometimes I need another kid to balance out, you know, how much I can talk at length. It's, you know, finding a way to simplify the information so they can pick it up, so they can understand it and grasp it. But a lot easier said than done, for sure.
One of the other things I wanted to circle back to that I think you even touched on recently was how do we create like a, you know, cause you're talking about the hit tracks and how that's, you know, are they focused on the right things that are going to translate to the game? And one of the things to go back to, how we're talking about, like, well, let's say you hit one pitch, like, you know, a fastball, like, you know, maybe middle in, and you hit it really well, and then you get that same pitch again. Well, by the mere fact of you, having hit that ball, before, well, let's say it didn't leave the park. Well, maybe next time you come up, the defense now shifts, and now there's somebody standing real close to that spot that you hit the ball previously. Now, all of a sudden, that's a different problem. Now, let's say you hit it over the fence. Well, what happens? You go to a different ballpark, and the dimensions are different, and that ball just cleared the fence. That ball may now be caught or catchable. So, That's kind of another way of, like, I'm trying to think of like practice design. Like, how do I put in, let's say we're in a cage environment, how do I shift up that to like create a game that's similar to like what Rob Gray was doing with the like wall of ground ball prevention? And if he wasn't the initial guy that did that, I think he was, though, but maybe it was a different professional organization. But I actually think that he we're going to credit it to him anyways. You know, how do we add an element like that into our cage setting where we can start to actually now manipulate areas where they can score points, you know, like do like a game and switch that up in a way that we can like that a defense might be shifted? Because like, let's say guys don't shift at all. But what about the teams that are going to change where they play based upon double play depth? You know, ground ball up the middle
definitely
used to be like a single, but now one that you hit more up the middle, now those guys in the middle are a lot closer to that and they can range over, and then it's an easy double play for them. So that's where, like, just only rewarding hitting the ball back up the middle isn't always going to be beneficial. Maybe you're creating inflexibility in that hitter when, you know, like, we've seen them shift dramatically, you know, and leave the whole left side or like a huge hole on the left side open. And it's like, we've seen how many guys be able to just like slap ground balls through to get on base, and then somebody comes up and hits a 2-run bomb. That's way more impactful than a 1-run bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seriously. And it's funny that you bring that up, because I was just working with a college hitter this week. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, I'm crushing the ball, but I just keep hitting everything to the center fielder. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, well, you know, it was at first I didn't know. I was like, okay, well, we can go one of two ways, because we can stay where you're at, because you might be in a place where, you know, a hit is coming and you're on a good streak of piecing up baseballs.
Mm-hmm.
But the other five, like, okay, well, or we could just get better at either getting that out a little more and pulling it to left center where there's no fielders, or, you know, trusting the ball getting a little deeper and go right. Like, there's different avenues you can go to approach the same problem. And that was one of the things that I think, I don't know that enough kids have a good feel for. Like, when you do simulated games in a cage setting, like, I remember, you know, even when I was in high school and in college, we obviously didn't have hit tracks. So we knew, like, no, that's caught, because the center fielder would be playing here on a runner here, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, a lot of the kids now, they don't have hit tracks or wraps. So they wait for that feedback to know. It's like, hey, that ball wasn't hit very hard, even if it was up the middle, like you said, you know. So there's what type of balls actually get through, what type of, you know, flights on balls in a cage actually apply to the same flights on the field. So playing with, you know, what you're saying with, like, okay, well, what if a fielder is standing in a different position? How does that affect, you know, what you think you have to do? Right. And so with center field approach, there's guys on both sides of it. You got Altuve, who's trying to hit every ball in BP, like, he explains in a video, I'm trying to hit the H in center field, right? So high fly ball to center. And then you got a guy like, I think it was Stan Musial who was saying, like, you know, the only place you don't want to hit a fly ball is the center field.
Yeah.
So, sure. Like, you know, one of them might be talking about BP. One of them might be talking about the game. One of them might be talking about both. Like, you know, what they mean is going to be unique to them. But, you know, how that ties up with the given constraints, like, you have to know what your swing and what you as a hitter are capable of, and then how does that best, like, suit the environment that you're in, right? Oh, I'm really good at pulling balls. I'm really, really good at pulling the baseball, but this pitcher is happening, like, to locate everything away. Do I change my swing? Do I change my visual approach? Do I change where I'm standing in the box? Maintain my same approach because I don't change who I am as a hitter. Is my coach going to pull me if I don't make an adjustment? You know what I mean?
Like, sure.
There's so many things that get, you know, skipped. So I think when we use constraints in the training environment, like, explaining why we use the constraints and tying it back, like, hey, like, let's pretend like this is happening and you're only getting pitched this. I know you're not very good at this drill, but we have to do this because, you know, it simulates this angle of a pitcher. It simulates this trajectory of this pitch. And then it's like, there's a little more buy-in after the fact.
Oh, for sure.
When they know how it ties back, like you said, I think that's like providing more relevant information for them to make connections. But if it's just, you know, purely, okay, we must do this move. You know, what if the move doesn't work right away? What if that move was intended to be learned at a later period? You know, there's a lot of factors that can affect it with the physical that we're unaware of, but we do know the game of baseball and the constraints that places on us. So I think it's more important that we meet the demands of baseball before we try to attack the demands of whatever efficient means, you know?
Oh, for sure. Totally agree. And like the one thing that I wanted to add in terms of, like, because I thought you brought up a good point of, it's really hard to tell in a cage what is actually going to be successful in a game. And that's where, for me, I really want to focus on just making them a better problem solver. So by that, I mean like giving them different problems to solve. So when they get into the game, it's just another problem to solve. So like by changing where the points are throughout, you know, the game or whatever we're doing in the cage, we'll then simulate to them having to adjust and problem solve when things shift in a game. That's kind of how like I would try to address that issue of, you know, does this, what we're doing in a cage actually translate to the field? I mean, because so much changes that once you go from cage to the actual field, from a perceptual standpoint, that, maybe it's not actually always that big of a deal, but still, I think that would be my approach to kind of deal with some of the limitations of being stuck in a cage.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's just funny, like you just said everything that I'm thinking, but what you're saying about problem solving, it's like one of the first things I wrote last night when thinking about stuff that we talk about. It's like, how do I make an elite problem solver? Like, put it this way, I always applied, you know, physics from high school to everything else after that. And I found a way to apply it to baseball, to basketball, to whatever was relevant at the time.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, for sure. So in most physics problems, you're usually studying specific, you know, law or phenomena that's happening, and you have formulas and they give you like three of the given variables.
Okay.
And in order to find the answer, you have to find the two unknown variables, and then that leads you to plug and chug in the formula. So it's not enough to know the formula. It's not enough to know the given information. You have to be able to create nonlinear connections. And nonlinear connections is like the phrase I've written about 17 times in the last 2 weeks, is because it's the ability to solve problems. Like when you can learn how things outside of that specific task apply, you know, it gives you more perspective. So I think, you know, something you said earlier was, you know, how could we make them, you know, almost see different things so that they weren't, when they come back to, you know, something they've come across before, they can maybe have a different perspective on it. And, you know, that idea got me thinking, because I was like, okay, well, not everybody wants to be a big leaguer. Not everybody wants to be the best hitter, but a lot of people do. And I was thinking, I was like, if I could tell a former version of myself something, you know, in terms of my process to, you know, trying to make it to the big leagues, like I would tell myself that if I made other things, you know, outside of baseball more important, I would have had a lot better balance in life. And if I would have had a better balance in, you know, the rest of my life, I believe it would have facilitated, you know, a different performance, maybe better. Because like you said, you know, when life gives you perspective, like, you know, a lot of the problems in baseball, you come back to them, it's like, oh, like that's a completely different way of thinking about it. Right. You know, like, for example, if I can apply that directly, you know, there's a kid who absolutely hated same side angle toss. Basically, you know, he's a righty, I'm on the right side, and I'm lofting everything like as if it was, you know, curveball slider mix. And he hated that angle. So, you know, he has a decent fall. And I think one game where he's, you know, he didn't have a bad game, but he came in after and he's like, you know, whatever, I got my hits, but it's just like, it doesn't feel right. I don't know what it is. And, you know, not feeling right in a game was a way bigger problem than I'm not very good at same side angle toss. Yeah. So that day, whatever it was, his, you know, mental state, he was just crushing same side. And he was like, oh my gosh. Like, you know how you've been telling me, you know, swing down out front. For that guy, that was what he was thinking about. So we were kind of playing with that idea. And he's like, I just had to do that. And it's like, in my head, my initial reaction was like, dude, I've been telling you that for 2 weeks, but you know, it takes something else to give them new perspective on the same information. So like that aspect of like, hey, how can I apply, you know, different things outside of this one task to another? It's like, hey, remember how you felt that one good thing in BP? Like, well, let's try and play with it in front of us, a more controllable setting. And I think going back to one of your early questions is like, you know, how was I able to simplify my notes, or how did my notes actually help me? It was like, Well, I had already kind of solved those problems before. So if I solved my problems before on paper, it was like, well, I knew I had something to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
So finding out how you problem solve, like that's, like you said, it's way more important than how do I hit this baseball better. It's like, well, if you problem solve and learn how to do that well, I don't have to tell you. We can just help you find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can get to a point where, you know, instead of us asking all the questions, like if we get to a point where they start asking, you know, deeper questions about themselves, about their own swings, it's like now we're drawing deeper understanding. And like, it's just like the memorization and understanding thing. It's like, you can memorize all you want, but you can't memorize moves as well as you can understand why they work, you know?
Sure. I mean, I think the one thing that's interesting that you brought up is, I think a lot of times, and this is true in a lot of life, of like, we know what we like, you know, there's different sort of cues. And for whatever reason, like, we're really resistant to being like, all right, let's just jump to that thing and try it out and like, just check it off the list. We're like, nah, I want to do it a different way. And then finally, when you do it, you're like, man, why didn't I do this earlier? Like,
yeah.
And it, I don't know. Like, it's just something weird. I've even noticed it of myself. Like, it's just sometimes we kind of like, we have to, again, like maybe kind of to the non-linearity component to it of like, you know, that path to getting to that spot of, you know, having it click is just not a linear one. But anyways, I want to be respectful of your time. Anything that you want to kind of end with?
I guess I would just say to kind of close it all, and you know, the more that you've encouraged me to dive into this stuff, the same way you said to me last, it's really changed my perspective on how many factors affect the performer. If you have an idea of all the things that can, it's not like you can guarantee a great job, but you can definitely guarantee that you're doing a better job just because you're paying attention to the various factors that that can help them and hurt them. So yeah, it's been really interesting. I'm gonna keep diving in for sure.
Awesome, man. I love that. Well, where can people find you if they want to connect with you and or you know, stay up to date with what you're up to?
I'm mostly on Twitter. I would say that's where I talk the most. But yeah, Twitter with my name, Brian Pozos, I believe, Brian.Pozos.
Do you want to let people know how to spell it? Cause I know like I spelled your last name wrong until I actually like looked at it.
Yeah. It's, Brian with an I, Brian, and Pozos, Pozos.
So I'm looking it up right now. It's Brian_Pozos. So for people who want to follow Brian, you should totally do it. And he's at 108 Performance out in Tustin and Riverside. So give him a follow. And then till next time, Brian, it's been great having you on.
Yeah. Thanks, Garrett. Appreciate you having me. Okay.